Welcome back to the GVO Talk Show, the good vibes only talk show. My guest today is a solo entrepreneur, influencer, and medical student, also known as Christopher Creel. In today's interview, he shares insights on Read to Rise, he gives out knowledgeable advice, and we talk about a list of important topics. For example, health, motivation, sleep, running, how to build good habits. The list goes on. As usual, we are uncut, unfiltered, and uncensored. And enjoy an insightful podcast.
Nice to be back again. It's been a while.
It's been a while. I'm 99% sure. No, it's a fact. You were the first episode ever filmed on the podcast.
Or like filmed with a video.
Yes, filmed with a video. One of the OG films, like on the phone, no setup, at the start.
If you look back at that and how far, because I think if you go back, it's been around exactly 2 years since we filmed that one. And if you just go look first, like what we looked like, how we were articulating our sentences, how shitty the quality of the videos were, and then you fast forward 2 years, you've got this great setup here. I didn't even think back then that I would have a page like Read to Rise, and I'm almost at a total of 1 million followers, and that's just in a small 2 year span of small actions that we took to bring us here, which is, it's pretty cool to think back on.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. Earlier this week I was running through a bunch of clips for just like an introduction, and I was like, you know, a nice YouTube introduction would be taking it from the start, from the first clips, and just like working through it. And when you go along that journey, it might feel like the other day, but it's like progressed so much that it's actually very interesting to like look back on it. It's quite cool.
Yeah, it was a blink of an eye, and here we are. And you would think things just happened overnight, but there was so many struggles. You know how I always say, me and you, we like to struggle before we get anywhere. So a lot of mistakes we had to make, a lot of downs we had to go through. I mean, we still are, but now, going in the right direction finally.
So I wanted to ask you, what was the initial motivation for Read to Rise that sort of sparked up the idea of, I will create content on bettering yourself?
Well, the easiest and most honest answer for that is for money.
The honest is the best answer most of the time.
Yes, I was really struggling back then. My rent prices got increased a lot. The South African rand, which in I received my money, went down, and I couldn't afford a place to stay anymore. I slept on my friend's couch, on Kenny's couch, and it was a real low point. By that point, I already started Read to Rise, but it was not doing well. So I started it because I knew I was going to need money very soon. And then I first had to become homeless before I took it seriously enough.
Just like a quick sidetrack, but yeah.
Yeah, but so, and then it started picking up, and it started doing really well, and I started making enough money. My goal was, it was very simple. I need 200 euros a month extra to be able to call it successful and just to cover my expenses. That was it, to just be able to live and have an apartment and stuff. I needed 200 euros a month. I reached that, and then I started blowing up, and it got way more. I hit my first month of $2,000 a month, and I thought, okay, this is some different potential here. And then people started messaging me about, like, a few months in, when people started taking my advice and applying it to their life and stuff, I regularly get messages of, you know, thank you so much for inspiring me, you've really helped me get out of this dark place. So now my motivation has switched a lot away from money and more towards helping people. because now I'm stable, I'm stabilized, so I don't care about the money anymore. Obviously, who doesn't care about money, but it's not my main objective anymore. Now, seeing that I can actually reach thousands of people and have a true impact on their lives is way more motivation. Having a true purpose and a passion is a bigger motivation than money.
You were talking about how it came from a very like dark, challenging place, the success. And there's this really good quote from Robin Sharma I got straight from 5 AM Club. "Give me a challenging life, one that brings out the finest in me. For this makes an iron will and an unquenchable character." And this is something I've been thinking about for a while, but a lot of the times people that are extraordinary come from a challenging situation. That's where they make that breakthrough. That's where they get that motivation and that purpose to change their life almost. Does this resonate at all with the Read to Rise or even just your life in general?
Yeah, I feel it's very well said, and you can see it just comes back to that of comfort kills dreams. You have to create discomfort to make progress. So where people who did not come from naturally tough backgrounds, they would have to create discomfort for themselves. That's why you will see these more successful people, they will sign up for tough events, marathons, or they will every morning they will do a cold plunge, and some people will for 6 weeks sleep on the ground and not on a bed. They create this discomfort that kind of pushes them to reach their goals. But you see, yes, you're correct. You see it all the time. People coming from trauma, what's the word for poor? Poverty.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just slip your mind. So people coming from poverty and stuff, I think it really, because then you grow into this family where you observe the people around you being miserable all the time, and you just don't want to be that way. And it always only takes one person to bring an entire family, an entire friend group out of their situation of misery.
To change.
Yeah.
Yeah. I 100% agree with that. On top of that, comfort brings a softness, it brings like a certain type of, almost you get demotivated if you are in too much comfort. I mean, most of the people in the world who succeed, they strive for this comfort. It feels like I'm just taking the words that you just said and just repeating it again, but if you don't want to do something, go and do it. At the end of the day, that is the thing that you need to go do. If you hate a cold shower, do it once a week. Once a week. That does not mean you need to constantly shower in the cold. If you hate running, personally, I hate running. I have a deep love-hate relationship with running, because even though I hate it so much, that...
despise it.
Oh, like, just to put your shoes on and get ready, I would find the randomest things to procrastinate on just to start the run. But when you start running and you get through that initial, I also want to say that initial like struggle, once you overcome that and you do the run, at the end you feel great. Like that pain is something you need. Like just before this we were talking and I was like, yeah, I'm sort of looking forward for a run we're doing this weekend. And it's sort of that struggle to do that pain. Like, sometimes the pain is good for you. Putting yourself outside of the comfort zone and just, like, pushing through that. I really do enjoy that challenge.
I have another example straight from Read to Rise and my recent life experiences with comfort and discomfort, it's very easy to put in perspective this way because everything happened over a 12-month period. So I can go back to August, September last year. This is where I lost my place to live. This is where I went to a friend. Extreme discomfort. Extremely uncomfortable to go to your friend and tell him, listen, please, I need to stay on your couch for a few months. And to be in his space, and you know you're bothering his studies, you're bothering his day-to-day space. You're just there. So that's very discomfort, being a hassle to someone.
I assume for you as well.
I'm talking about me. This is my discomfort.
Yes.
It's horrible. I'm sleeping on a couch. I don't know. I don't see a way out. And I'm making my friend uncomfortable as well. That insane motivation. I was working all day to get out of that situation because it's so uncomfortable. You don't want to stay there. So trust me, you will work as much as it takes. Worked my ass off, started making quite a bit of money, and then comfort sets in. Now I have the money, now I have a new apartment, it's very nice, I'm comfortable. I just accept, okay, I made it now. I'm not rich, I'm not a millionaire, but I have money that puts me comfortable. And I just started spending it and having fun, and guess what? That money disappeared instantly. It didn't continue coming in because I wasn't working as hard anymore because now I was comfortable. So I thought I can just maintain this by working a bit lighter. And that simply is not true. Once you get that comfort and you take your foot off the gas pedal, the success will go away.
Yes. So
it's important to keep that discomfort.
So from a third person perspective, you look on people that get success and stuff like that, you see it as a smooth ride almost. A lot of the times looking from the outside, you don't see the challenges that go through. What were some of the hardest challenges you faced on creating Re2Rise to become where it was?
I would say the hardest challenge was around March of this year when I got to that point where I had a few thousand dollars saved up and now I wanted to take it to the next level. And I got on a call with a lot of people, a lot of, so to say, professionals on how to take it to the next step, how do I make more money from this massive audience that I have made? How do I give them value, first of all? I don't just want to take money from them. What can I give to these people that is worth their money, that can make their lives better? And I got on calls with many people that know email marketing, that know how to set up sales funnels, that knows all these technical things, especially sales, I'm very bad at. And I found the right guy, signed a deal, started paying him $2,000 a month. It's a lot of money. And I didn't see any results. I blew through all of my savings. And the ads that he had me put in front of my audience killed my engagement, killed my growth. I honestly thought I messed it up. I thought, here goes everything that I worked for. No, my views went to shit. No one's following me anymore. No one's trusting me anymore because they think I'm trying to press a product to them. Had to fire this guy. He wanted to sue me because we had a 6-month contract. Had to go through that. Luckily, there was no legal action taken. But I would say that would have been the hardest challenge until now. And the lesson that I took from that is that it is very important when you start a new pursuit, whether it be a side hustle, a page, a business, a degree, whatever, learn the base skills first. If you want to create videos, you have to learn editing because you can't hire someone to do editing if you don't understand editing. If you want to do sales and you want to write sales emails and you want to hire someone to do it, how will you know if they are doing it well if you haven't done it yourself, if you haven't written 100 or 200 emails before to kind of figure out what works? How can you hire someone to do it for you? So that's a big lesson I learned now, is to really build those core skills first.
On that point of, you reached a certain point where you were like, for me to go to the next level, I need to change a lot. I need to learn new skills. I need to get better, not just better, but work on a bunch of new things. With my podcast, I've also experienced that same thing of that, to a certain level, you can produce content, and then you're like, okay, but for me to reach the point I want to reach, it's time to level up. You need to take steps to it. And there's a lot of turmoil that happens from that transition period of going from being this rookie, having my phone on the table, talking bullshit, having fun with friends, to, okay, but I see a bit more in this. Okay, let me invest in something. Then that turns into a new mic, a new camera, a new software. And it's a constant learning curve that you need to go through. But I do think there's like plateaus that happen. We're like, okay, I need to upgrade myself now. I need to get to the new level. And to do that, it's not an easy thing to do. And if you get unlucky with a contract or something like that, luckily that hasn't happened with me yet. I don't think I've hit it big as you, but to a certain level, like, it does, yeah, it gets tough in that transition period.
And I also believe that we are all innately very lazy. We don't want to do the shit work. I hate writing, even though I want to be an author one day. I hate writing. It's the shittest thing. I hate writing sales emails. I hate writing my newsletter. I hate writing scripts for videos. I also dislike editing. These are the shit work, but we have to do it to get to the next level. I don't know if you've heard of this book called 10x is easier than 2x. But
I've seen it. I've not looked into it. No.
It's an entrepreneurship book. And well, the title speaks for itself. It's easier to get 10x results than it is to get 2x. It's easier to 10x your income than it is to 2x it. Because to 2x it, you have to do these mind-numbing, excruciating small things over and over and get better at them. And constantly work with the same type of clients, same type of things. But 10x, you have to reform yourself and your way of thinking, and you essentially become a totally different person to reach that. So we all have gone 10x in our lives. I had to go 10x, you have to let go. He uses the Pareto principle to explain this, the 80-20 rule. So 20% of your results come from 80% of your actions. So 20% of your money or your things come from those 80%. So now the book is based on the principle that you put more focus on the 20% and let go of the 80%. And then that 20% becomes your new 80%. So for your next 10x jump, you have to let go of that 80% and become that. So my 20% at the moment is making better content, writing better emails, and editing. But that is going to become, if I continue doing this, I'm going to continue making $2,000 or $3,000 a month. If I want to 10x and get to $20,000 a month, this is going to become my 80%. So once I'm good enough at this, this will become my 80%, which I will then let go of and hire people to do that so that I can focus on my next 20%, my bigger product, my one-on-one mentorship, whatever the next 20% would be, where the road takes it. But then you focus on that, and then that 20% you will outsource again and take it to the next level. These constant 10x jumps is how he refers to it.
Regarding the Pareto principle, do you know where it comes from originally? It's actually a thing that often comes forth.
I can't remember the story. Give it a recap.
So I'm 90% sure this guy Pareto, I'll AI check it in like a minute, but this Italian guy Pareto, he started like looking around at ground in Italy, and 80% of the properties and ground in Italy was owned by 20% of the people. And how it happened that it started like becoming a almost set rule, this 80-20 rule, like how often do you hear it? In Google, for example, they use it where 80% of the problems is in 20% of the code.
No.
So if you can solve the, if you can find and solve the 20%, 80% of the problems disappear. And I'm sure you can find much more information about it.
It carries over to every aspect of your life. 80% of your results from fitness is going to come from 20% of your efforts. It's going to come from those high yield exercises, those times where you really push yourself. And the rest, the same with diet. 80% of your results can come from 20% of what you eat.
So where does the Pareto principle come from? So it originates from the observations made by the Italian economist Vilfredo Pareto in the late 19th and early 20th century. In 1896, while studying wealth distribution in Italy, Pareto noted that approximately 80% of the land was owned by 20% of the population. And then from there on, it seems like they kept on building on it, because the term Pareto principle was popularized by management consultant Joseph M. Durang in the 1940s, when he applied Pareto's observation to quality control and improvement processes within organizations. Durin emphasized that focusing on the vital few, the 20%, could lead to significant improvements in productivity and efficiency. So pretty much exactly that we were referring to earlier.
I also think I owe, and I think you might feel the same way, because we study really fast. We study really fast and really well, and I think we owe our academic success to the Pareto principle. I think I'm very good at identifying the core 20% of the information that I have to study that gets me 80% of the results. And that's why I can go through exams so fast and finish early and go on trips. I know you do the
very
same.
Yeah, I'm very lucky in that aspect. Well, I think I create a lot of discomfort for other people, or like, for me, I know I need to study. I understand that I need to graft, and when I graft very hard. But a lot of the times, I can totally see from people looking out on the outside to me, I'm this guy that has a pretty okay work-life balance. I enjoy doing my fitness. I enjoy partying a few times. Quite often, I guess. And then I study also a lot. You find me always in the library. That's where you find me. And it's not necessarily that I think I know how to identify the 20% well, but I know the content that I need to go through, and I understand sort of where I'm lacking in that content. Because a lot of it, I don't think it's that necessary. Like you, especially in veterinary and medicine, which is high-yield subjects, like you have lots of volume to go through in a small amount of time. And to gather what you need out of that, like to summarize it almost in only the essential, the vital points, that's a very hard thing to do. But I guess I'm lucky in the way that I can manage that, I don't need to go through that. I feel, yeah.
It's to me, it came down to, you know, everything is systems. Medicine is just systems, veterinary systems. There's the biochemical systems, there's the physiological systems, the anatomical system, blah, blah, blah. Just get your base strong. I spent so much time so much time in understanding the basics in first, second, and third year that fourth, fifth, and presumably sixth year is going to be very easy for me because I learned the basics so well that I don't have to go spend time revising all of it again. And you can just break everything down into its piece and kind of study it for us. I don't know, studying is a skill that I've noticed that most people, they think it's an innate talent, that you are born with it. I get told this a lot. Oh, you're just smart.
Yeah, you're just smart. Yeah.
You're just smart. No the fuck I'm not.
Do you know how hard I work? It's sort of like how it goes in my head. Yes.
Like, I have a growth mindset. I struggled to study. Things were not sitting right with me, a lot of things, especially anything involving chemistry. And there's a lot of chemistry in what we do. Never stuck with me. And I always said, I'm not a chemistry guy, or I'm not a visual person, so I can't study using these methods. But then you're just limiting yourself. And it applies to anything, any skill you want to learn. You can't just say, you're just good with money, or, you know, you're just a good rugby player. That was one that was also, I always thought other people are just good rugby players, or good does, but everything is something you can learn by working at it. You just break it down to its core skills, little skills. Oh, you have to do this little thing every day. Every day I had a little 10-minute visualization exercise. I did that for months to help me get better at the visualization, memorization practices that I wanted to apply to my studies. And then people say, but you're just smart. But they don't see the hours of you being frustrated, not being able, like, because the skill doesn't just come, it starts with so much frustration, so much.
Ooh.
And that's where most people give up.
The amount of times I get, like, angry, like, just from pure frustration of putting in hours of something and then sort of just, at the end of the day, just need to scrap it because it's not, especially with editing and stuff like that, that often happens. A lot of times where it's like, okay, I did put all this effort in, but unfortunately there's no output I can get out of it because it's a new skill that's getting learned that not always works out. Catching a ball, for example. The first time you needed to catch a ball. You didn't catch it the first time. You didn't catch it one hand the first time.
You just got hit in the face.
Yeah, you just got bloody nerves. Like, you just move on. And then, second time it doesn't happen, third time it doesn't happen. Around the 10th time, maybe you're catching one ball out of every 5 throws. And then it, like, progressively gets better, and it just, that's just how it is. And regarding the whole thing of saying, oh, I'm just not a chemistry guy. I'm just not a maths guy. I'm just not a language guy. Same with me. I constantly give that excuse of, I'm just not a good writer. I am just bad with languages. It maybe doesn't come as easily as other people can. I think I have a very natural talent with math. That comes super natural to me. Maybe it's because I also drilled it in a lot. I really enjoyed doing it, so it was never a...
Yeah, so you just did more of it than other people have.
Yes.
You did more of it when you were younger.
While I was starting that curve early, where I didn't touch spelling and writing. I never wrote. Do I thoroughly enjoy writing, though? I really enjoy the whole philosophy and picking out the thoughts as you write down certain things, because it gives you time to go through what your thoughts actually want to say. Because if you just talk and you just da, 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 you just blur on, a lot of the times you don't completely process what you actually want to process. But if you sit down for an hour and you just write, there's this concept you want to think about, or there's this plan you want to set up, there's a lot of these things. If you just sit down and write down, you can create a much clearer image in your head of how to get there or how to create what you want to create.
Yeah, I agree. The writing that I hate is writing for other people to read. But I love writing for myself. I love journaling. I love creating plans, putting down my thoughts, philosophizing.
Yeah.
That,
a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
So if you needed to take Read to Rise, started as a blank page, started from the start, how would you do it different?
If I could do one thing, well, obviously it's like I wouldn't do anything different because it worked so well. Like you don't see someone reach almost 1 million followers in less than a year very, very rarely. But if I had to do something different, I would have made it more personal from the beginning. Because now I'm trying to make the switch to make it more personal and contain, you know, more of my face in my daily life, so that people know who I am and I'm not just a page. So I would have liked to incorporate that earlier. Little stories of myself, little videos where I'm actually talking with my face in, mixed in between, so that I was a part of the growth and not something new to introduce now. Because the engagement on stuff that contained me are super low. Yesterday I posted a story of me in the surgery room, and I just got flooded with messages where everyone's like, oh, I thought you were just an influencer. And I was like, what? Okay. And I guess, I don't know, well, that, it felt insulting.
Meanwhile, you've been like, fifth year doctor, like.
Yeah, I don't know, it felt insulting. And then, now it seems like I somehow built more of a trust with people because they see me as a guy that's more than just a video guy or something. So I would have liked personal branding a bit more if I could change one thing. I believe a personal brand is very important going into the future for everyone. Doesn't matter what you do, you need an online presence. Go look at, everyone has online presence. Yesterday I had a dinner with my roommate's parents, Rue. His dad is a very high-up surgeon in South Africa. Obviously, that guy, he doesn't care about social media and stuff, but go look, he has a solid LinkedIn profile. Like, everyone has some sort of brand on the internet so that people can find you.
You need to be found,
yeah.
Somehow.
You need your brand. You are your brand. Everyone doesn't need it, but it definitely helps. It definitely helps to have a personal brand, especially if you want to focus on, you know, content creation and stuff. Yeah, that's a topic.
So, talking about your personal brand, I would like to talk about health and habits, things that you believe in or certain health aspects. And to start it off, I found a very interesting study, I think like two weeks ago, and I've been meaning to bring it up, but I just hadn't had the chance. So they started like doing studies on Labradors, or multiple studies. The first one was on rodents, the other one was on Labradors, primates as well. And they found that, especially with diets, lifelong restriction may extend life by up to 50% in rodents, with progressively less impact the later in life it is started. The effect is matched by profound impacts on age-related diseases, including reduced risk of cancer, neurodegenerative disorders, autoimmune diseases, cardiovascular diseases, and type 2 diabetes mellitus. This is just with rodents. They did the same with Labradors, with a 25% restriction in food intake would increase the median lifespan and delay most chronic diseases in dogs. I find it such an interesting study because it's so fitting in today's time. Very fitting where how many percentage of the population are in a caloric, not restriction, but rather over intake, just leading to obesity and this chronic illnesses, I'm pretty sure you see quite often in the hospital, that chronic diseases, heart diseases, diabetes, all these different things, are mostly found in people that are chronically obese, that have weight, extra weight on them. Because I don't think, no beef on the Hungarians, but they do have a little bit of a not the best diet sometimes. They have a little bit
of obesity. They have a, you could put it out there, it's horrible. Their diets are horrible. They are the second most obese country in the world. That's just facts, it's numbers. But it's hard to say with studies like these, because there's so much to unpack there. Go, a 25% decrease of what? What is the baseline of this? What other things do these animals do? Are these simple isolated studies where they are kept in cages, and there's a baseline given to these animals, and there's 25% less given to these animals, and you have your control group, and you have this group, and they're not allowed to exercise, and then you check over yours.
Research of, like, is the restrictive diet actually the causation, or...
Yeah, like, was it isolated as the only thing? Did you cut out exercise and environmental factors and other things, and then have a solid control group to compare them with? How? Because a lot of these studies, they throw these things out there, but it's way more complex than it is. You'll see people make, yes, okay, obese people 100% have more incidence of diabetes, heart failure, kidney failure, hormonal imbalances, you name it, they have it. But they are also more likely to have all the other bad habits. They're also likely to drink a lot of alcohol. They're likely to be smokers. They're likely to overeat. They're likely not to exercise. So it's very hard to pinpoint it as just obesity. So that's why...
And just food intake.
Yeah, just like, how can you say it's just food? Because it's also about quality of food, not only quantity. You can eat a lot less than another person, but you are eating a lot of processed foods, and you're going to be likely to have colon cancer.
Yeah. It's a tough thing to look into. This is the thing about, like, studies that I find interesting. It's very complex, and a lot of times it's not just black and white. You can't... For me, I read this, and I thought it as very interesting, because I think I'm very lucky. Nah, I wouldn't even call it lucky. I've trained myself well enough to know what my body needs and what it doesn't need. I know when I'm overeating, and I know when I am content with the amount of food I take in, which leads to me being quite healthy amongst my peers. And reading this whole thing of, you have significant health impacts if you, or health span increases if you compare these two, even though it's a bit of a black and white study, I found it about very interesting.
There's other studies. I fully believe what the study is saying. I'm just also trying to highlight that, you know, you need to be wary of what you read, because these studies are usually extremely biased, because it's usually made by students that just want to get something published. And it's usually published in, like, PubMed or something. So it comes from a tier one peer-reviewed journal. I would usually trust it. But we were warned off in med school, especially, do not trust anything on PubMed. Like,
PubMed,
90% of it is biased and untrue. That's where you would also find all these science-based lifting articles where people are like, oh yes, you should have this optimal contraction time for hypertrophy and stuff. Guys doing that study is a gym bro that puts a EMG on you, and then he's like, yes, kind of looks better on that zone, and he writes it down on the paper.
Good point. Straight from National Library of Medicine from PubMed.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's very... Shouldn't published papers be, you know, valid at the end of the day?
That's what you would think, but most most literature is very.
I think
very
most
biased.
Common people do think that.
Because if you are spending 2-3 years on a project, and you had a hypothesis, and you wanted to see these results, you're going to ignore the things that are telling you something else. And you're just going to put emphasis on this one thing that is showing the results that you want. And it happens a lot. It doesn't mean that everything, that you should be a bit more weary about what you eat. I do believe in this, that a little bit of calorie restriction, I wouldn't say calorie deficit, you need maintenance calories, obviously,
otherwise you're going to starve.
Yeah. And you need certain nutrients. It's just, if you just eat chicken and rice, your microbiome is going to be fucked.
Most probably. Yeah.
there's a lot there. Like, nutrition is, it's not as hard as people make it. Eat slower. This is one big thing. The satiety hormone, leptin, the one that makes you feel full, it takes 20 to 30 minutes to take effect. So eat slower, then you'll eat less automatically. Chew your food better, your stomach is gonna
absorb.
Yeah, move it through better, because if you have big chunks in there, the stomach acid can only help that much, and that leads to acid reflux later, and acid reflux in the long run becomes bad, high risk of cancer, everything, especially in obese people, once again. So that the simplest one, eat slower, chew your food better. That's already going to make it easier to eat less. Maybe decrease your intake by 5%. Then the balance of foods, just eat natural. Eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. I don't eat that much vegetables personally. I do sometimes, but I eat a lot of fruits. You want the fibers for your microbiome. Full fat, natural yogurts, very good for your microbiome. Olive oil, very good for you. Nuts, legumes, seeds, great sources of protein and natural fats and oils. And yeah, then just stay away from processed things. That's it. None of these little square floppy cheeses and salamis and all of these things that are so nice to snack on. They're so bad for you. Just stick to natural stuff. Stick to natural stuff, have fruits, have some olive oils, have some yogurts. Don't get processed yogurts. If it's low fat, they have to put a lot of other things in there. Just take the natural full fat ones. And that's it. Then you have a simple diet, eat a little bit less than you should. And then, yeah, just quickly, because I went off topic, what I wanted to say is there's this other study that is done on the people that live in these, I think they call them blue zones.
Yes.
Where the people are living to become more like, most of them become more than 100 years old. And all of them, you would find intermittent fasting as a key indicator of longevity. So coming back to that calorie restriction, missing a meal from time to time. And that's just because your body needs to metabolically switch. We're not supposed to be fully fed all the time. We evolved mechanisms for it. So if you're fully fed the whole time, those mechanisms aren't working, and they are, you know, anti-inflammatory, whatnot, blah blah blah.
A bunch of different things. I was just curious and wondering, where are blue zones actually? Because there's quite a few. Take a few guesses, like places, like countries that you think would have.
Okay, there's one. There's Italy.
Yes,
sure.
Sardinia.
Yeah, they've got the. There's definitely Greece.
The longest living men. Yeah, they have the longest living men. Yeah.
Yeah, was it Sicily?
Sardinia.
Sardinia.
Italy, yeah. Icaria, Greece.
Yeah, Greece, because that's where. What's the diet? The main diet.
Mediterranean.
Yeah,
super healthy diet.
Mediterranean diet is the best diet.
Fish, a lot of vegetables.
Yeah. Olive oil.
Oh yeah,
like
olive oils.
Stuff looking after your microbiome is super important, and I love to eat. I don't care what anyone says. Each person is different. I will eat meat until I die.
I do sort of think it was bred into us, like the fact that meat is such a big part of our culture that you can't. It would be so tough for me to go vegetarian, vegan, all the above. Too hard. I would go. I would much easier go on a straight carnivore diet than on a cold turkey vegan diet. Easy.
No, I'll, if I had access, I will eat red meat every day. I know a lot of people say red meat is bad for you. I don't believe it.
Okay, so you've got two places now.
Okay.
Get one more and then I'll be very impressed.
The Japan, those islands.
Okay, of course.
There was one that I found particularly interesting in the US, maybe around Philadelphia or something.
California. Yeah, USA, California. Loma Linda. I didn't even know that was a place, but Loma Linda is a blue zone.
Okay, these are maybe current blue zones? Maybe it was that place? I'm not sure. I'm feeling there was something on the East Coast.
This is the original five blue zones, so they might have, you never know, got more in and stuff like that.
Well, there was this settlement of people that they were all Irish that came over. It was outside of New York or on Philadelphia side or something. I can't remember where the place is. But they were looking for these contributing factors that is leading to longevity. Why are these people living so much longer than the rest? Because in the other blue zones, you get these answers. Oh, okay, they are exercising a lot, or you know, they have a Mediterranean lifestyle, or they live in this area with more oxygen, or whatever reason, they can always find these little correlations. But in this one, they couldn't. Everyone there is unhealthy as fuck. They are smoking, they are drinking.
Just like everything they tell you not to do to live longer. Yeah.
These people are living really long. All of them. And they couldn't figure out why. And then there was more psychological studies and stuff going on in the background, and they came back to this later. And they connected with all of them that the biggest contributing factor for longevity was community. Because they were all such tight-knit communities. Every neighbor knew each other, everyone was talking the whole time, everyone was hanging out for hours. Look at the Greeks, look at the Italians, look at the Irish kids. They would sit and they would have beers and they would have laughs and they would have fun hours into the night. And then in the morning they'll see each other again. It was just these tight-knit communities that led to this longevity.
Because you have a community that keeps you wanting to live.
Yeah, it's kind of a reason to live.
I think on the fact that you get like old people that go to old people homes and stuff like that, or become very lonesome, and then how many cases have you like heard of husband like long-lived marriage where the husband dies and then soon afterwards the wife dies.
Yeah.
I think it's the loneliness. What is the point of keep on living if you have nothing? Like, it sounds super deep and super sad and it's everything, but community I do think is very important. And that, like Greece, Italy, those type of places, they do have that community of I share something or I contribute. I think they do a lot of contribution of, they have like a small farm, maybe they have like a bunch of potatoes, and the neighbor has a bunch of carrots. I give you a bunch of potatoes, you give me some carrots. You know, it's fair trade. I give to the community, you give back to me. Most of the time they'll probably have wine on the way, talking a bit. Like, you know, that...
I think it gives your life some meaning. Gives that feeling of meaning. And that's a big contributing factor. You'll see now also a lot, like a big... What did they call it? They did some studies in the UK and the US. They call it the loneliness epidemic, where loneliness is directly leading to bad health consequences, because people are not, they're just sitting at home looking at videos the whole day, joking with, and that's their life.
Online, yeah.
And they're like, oh, why am I not happy? I don't know. It's because you're fucking your brain chemicals.
Very true. I think, but that like really happened after COVID. I don't want to go too deep into COVID.
Yeah, not at all, but I agree.
Yeah.
The isolation.
It made a big difference. I want to talk about it. I want to give you a quote. Tell me what you think about it. straight from Can't Hurt Me, David Goggins. In a society where mediocrity is too often the standard and too often rewarded, there's an intense fascination with men who detest mediocrity, who refuse to define themselves in conventional terms, and seek to transcend traditional recognized human capabilities.
You can take that even a step further, I would say, and be like, the bar to succeed is so low right now. To be great is not hard. It's just consistent. Yes, we all want to, like,
in mediocrity, there's a lot of competition.
Yeah,
in extraordinary, there's not a lot of competition.
And it doesn't... And now it does not even take a lot to surpass mediocrity. Because the mediocre is just so mediocre that just doing the basic things... Just doing the basic things right will put you in the exception. I was listening to a podcast earlier, and it was Alex Ramosi who said this.
He
said they were talking about basically keystone habits. So what is that? What is one of those habits that will just put you ahead of the rest? And he said, well, just go to bed on time. No one goes to bed on time. If you go to bed on time, you're more likely to be productive, you're more likely to be energized, you're more likely to be successful, you're less likely to get into shit, you're less likely to drink, you're less likely to get stabbed, you're less likely to get into car accidents, you're less likely to whatever. If all you do is go to bed on time, that's already going to put you above the mediocrity of people. Because who goes to bed on time? Who goes to bed at the same time every day? How many times? I don't even do it as consistently as I want, but about 80% of the time, I'm in bed early. How many times have our friends told me I'm a baby and made fun of me because I want to go to bed at 9? All the time.
I've definitely done it before as well.
Exactly. But it's one keystone habit.
No, I've also, as I say, I can't really preach, because at the end of the day, guys, I'm probably also a big fuck up. I do not sit every day, every hour of my day, reading books and exercising and all these go to bed at 10. I do them on a quite high frequency. I do them more often than not. But at the end of the day, I do party and I do have fun and I do keep all these different things. So it's not like I can preach this, but the amount of times where I stick to that habit of, okay, you know, 10 to 10:30, you're in the bed, getting ready to sleep, compared to the times where I go sleep at 1, 2. The next, if you need to compare the 2 days of the next day following that routine, it's worlds apart. It's worlds apart when you compare that early early going to bed compared to late going to bed. The productivity, you can't even compare. And it's just, yeah.
See, the goal is not perfectionism, but to at least consistently. Because you also have to be able to do these things, you need a why. You need a reason to why you're doing them. And yes, productivity, success, goals, everything, great reasons. But don't you also just want to live a happier life? Think about the days that you are hungover, or you just... Okay, yes, you like partying with your friends sometimes. I love it too. I make those sacrifices. I know what I'm doing when I'm prepared to be hungover. But what about those days that you just lie in your bed and you scroll mindlessly through videos and you go to sleep late for absolutely no reason? Your whole next day is ruined. What did you gain from that? You didn't gain some social fun and stories with your friends or something. You don't even remember what you saw. And you ruined your whole next day. And people feel... I feel like people think that life is so long. Like, you have so many days out there. I'm 25 years old. Maybe, if I'm lucky, I'll get to 75. So, one third of my life is done. 25 summers out of my 75 summers is done now. Every day matters, so why not go on time so that you can enjoy that day, go to bed on time, so that you can enjoy that day fully the next day, so that you can feel that true in the happiness, enjoyment. Yeah, just cut out the stuff that makes life less enjoyable.
I want to highlight a part of that quote. I know we explained the mediocrity compared to this extraordinary on the level of sleep and stuff like that. Talk with me a bit about exercise, about health, about how to keep yourself healthy on a physical manner. Because I do think there's three aspects to it. There's mental health, physical health, and then spiritual health. It all
and
like
even
sort
maybe
of,
if you want to throw in like a social health. I would put social health.
Social health, you can almost put it with mental. No, you can't.
I think it's separate. Because you can be mentally very happy by yourself.
And then socially very isolated as well.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a good. On the physical health part, especially as we were talking about earlier about challenging yourself and give me
once
some
again, for most people, 99% of people, I believe it's important to focus on the two most keystone habits. I think it's James Clear, the writer of Atomic Habits, that call them keystone habits because they reach so deeply into all the other parts. And we just discussed sleep, and sleep is super critical for recovery, especially, and immunity. So you don't want to get sick, and your immune system is also very important in fighting with cancer and stuff, and how long you live and how young you're going to look when you're 35. Sleep, super important for physical health. You want to look good and feel good and have a good heart health. And then the second one is exercise. Because if you're exercising, you're more likely to eat healthy. They just go together. And if you're exercising, you're more likely to sleep better. So they all kind of circle to each other and form other stronger habits. So you focus on the exercise.
And if that chain gets lost, does it just, I don't know.
Because I get lost a lot. I fuck up a lot, where I stop, where I break my habits. And, you know, we call that the degenerate days. When we're eating shitty and we're drinking and we binge drink, go 3-4 day benders, but I'll still exercise in that time, and it keeps me a little more zoned in.
At least you're doing something.
Yeah.
No, because
like you just need those few things that you stick to.
I'll be honest, I'm a sucker for a degenerate day.
Yeah.
But once in a while, that's the thing. You can't run it the whole time. You can't. I've let's say 2-3 days after like a good week and 2 weeks of properly living your life. I think this is, I'll go away from the degeneracy quickly. You were talking earlier about how certain, the way you live almost, it slipped my mind now. How people think you have so much time. That these times that you just like scroll mindlessly and stuff like that, and you just go on. I have, maybe this is just me, but my head works in a certain way where I feel like shit is going to change very fast. Regularly I have like this existential crisis of like, oh fuck, AI is coming. The world has been changing a lot. There's a lot of turmoil and no consistency going on. And that sort of drives, it's a turbo in the back of the engine. Being like, okay, the time to work is now. The time to work is now. The time to grind is not tomorrow, not next week, not in a year, not in a month. It's now. Unfortunately, if you blink for too long, you might miss a very essential scene in this movie that you can call life, I guess.
Yeah, because I mean, we all want to get the most out of it, don't we?
You want to live, like, yeah.
Like, I don't need to be Bill Gates or Elon Musk, but, like, I want to experience a first-class flight sometime in my life. I want to, you know, have no worries about holidays or taking care of my children, but I also want to have great stories to tell them from my 20s. So it's really hard.
You need a bit like a dad look.
Because now you're like, okay, I want to go into a 6-month craziness of just working, cutting myself off and setting myself apart. But then it's like, yeah, but I'll only be 25 once. I know, yeah, this is a very toxic way of thinking, actually, to keep saying, oh, but I'm only going to be 25 once, so might as well do this now. And then you just... that you're going to keep saying this, and then eventually you're going to reach nothing. You're not going to accomplish anything.
Interesting way of saying it.
That's the pitfall I keep falling into.
The amount of times I've told myself, I will do something, but I only say it to make me feel better about me not doing it. Almost like extending the excuse, and then at the end of the day, I never do it in any way. I'll be like, oh yeah, today I really need to do laundry. Am I doing laundry that day? Hell no. Most probably not. Okay, to end the podcast, I have one more quote I want to talk to you. And this is not from your page. Most of the stuff I got from your Instagram page, actually. And I want to almost leave it off with it. It's from Lao Tzu. He's a big philosopher from Taoism. Watch your thoughts, they become your words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become your habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. And this whole link of him starting from the basics of what you can control, your thoughts, and slowly building it up into words, into actions, into this long list of things, and at the end of the day that leads to your destiny, I find is so powerful and so stoic. So damn stoic.
Never undermine the power of a small action. Small action consistently applied leads to extraordinary results. It does not take...
Straight from Atomic Habits, if you can get 1% better each day for 1 year, you'll be 36 times better at the end of that year. Like, compounding interest is insane.
Yeah, it always feels like the results is not coming quick enough, but if you look back in a year, it feels like they came really fast. So... that perspective is really hard to have. Like, oh, damn, I'm not getting where I want, because you've been looking at it in the last month or 2 months. It's the frustration. But you go back a year or two, like, oh God, I can't believe how far I've come in 2 years. It is unperceivable because of those tiny actions I took, which comes back to this. Napoleon Hill also wrote it in Think and Grow Rich, and Think and Grow Rich was my first book. That introduced me into the realm of personal development and the power of thought. And I really appreciated that book because that's what it taught me. So I had it written on a sticky note and I would look at it every day where it says, sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. So a character, reap a destiny. So it was like this one, and I had it written, and I would look at it every day for a year, and it would just make me do that little bit. Because you can't perform. Top performance doesn't look like a straight line. You're not always at 100%. But maybe you're 100% today, 20% of you. Yesterday I didn't feel well, I didn't sleep well, I didn't do anything. I went for a 10-minute jog, I wrote and I journaled a bit. It was nothing. It took me 30 minutes to accomplish everything for that day, and the rest of the day I was pretty useless, and I stretched a little bit. But it was the best I had in me for that day. And then if you set out, if you do what you set out to do, you are 100% productive. If today you set out to binge watch series and rest, but you planned this before, it's not a procrastination, then you are 100% productive. And that's how I live my life.
Yeah, that is a good way to live it. That is a very good way to live it. And on that mark, thank you once again, Christopher. Good insights. I think probably one of my more educational podcasts, I would say. Most of the times it's just a bunch of yapping going on.
Yeah, it's hard to find coherent trains of thought in these things because you want it to be a little bit educational. But we'll get there at it.
Yeah.
Great podcast anyway. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you